months ago, I wrote to my fellow classmates, Jonathan Flatley, who is an English professor at Wayne State, and Mimi Long, who is a professor of East Asian Studies at UC Irvine, asking if they wanted to participate in a discussion about public higher education. And I also reached out to Andy Parker, who many of you may have had as a professor when he was here. And who now teaches in French and comparative literature at the Department of Rutgers. As we were starting to talk about public higher education over email, it did not take us long to voice despair. Is there a future for the liberal arts, and especially for the humanities, the disciplines we have devoted our careers to in public higher education? At this particular moment, when funding is decreasing and there is an increasing demand for public institutions of higher ed to align programs with the most pressing workforce needs. Added to this is anxiety among students who are going into terrible debt to fund their college educations and who, along with their parents, are evaluating majors in terms of the return on investment and the clear career pathways that those majors might help them forge. So the focus on workforce alignment disadvantages the disciplines that we have spent our lives teaching and studying. There is cause for this collective despair. You may have heard, for example, about the proposal at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point back in the spring of 2018 to close the following programs: American Studies, Art, English, French, Geography, Geoscience, German, History, Philosophy, Political Science, Sociology, and Spanish. I shared this list with my father when it came out, and he said to me, "In what sense would it still be a university?" Following national coverage and student protests, Stevens Point backed up from those proposals, and I know that there are a few of those programs that are still in danger of being cut, but they have walked back from cutting all of them. Still, the news that that would even have been considered, and all of those programs would have been cut at once, I think is really stunning for us. And I've heard that there are, you know, that people will just use Stevens Point as, we don't want to become, you know, we don't want to be in that position. I have spent my career in public higher education. I started as an English professor at Westfield State University 20 years ago this September. It's an institution that's just 45 minutes away from here. It started 18 years after Amherst was founded, but it has a very different institutional history. It's now a regional comprehensive university. It started as a normal school, so a training school for teachers. It has a long history, though, of commitment to the liberal arts. I've gone through the old catalogs and have found sort of statements about the value of Westfield education. And one catalog described the importance of the judicious mixture of liberal arts and professional training at Westfield. I love my work at Westfield. And I loved my education at Amherst College. And over the past 20 years, I have thought often about these two different institutions, the different opportunities they offer, the possibilities they create for their graduates, and the role they've played in my life, how my Amherst education has shaped how I teach at Westfield State, and how Westfield State has shaped my adult life and expanded how I think about college and the role that college can play in people's lives. So I've reflected on the transformative part, especially of the role that the liberal arts plays in these institutions. Because now some of my former students are 40, I have the benefit of hearing how they talk about their lives, and I carry their stories with me. I have a former student who grew up as a working class kid in Martha's Vineyard, came to Westfield to be a teacher, and discovered he was a poet and published his first book of poetry with Houghton Mifflin. I have another student who writes now about growing up in poverty and really reflecting on poverty, and she has published widely in the Times and Boston Globe, all over the place. And I think again about what Westfield made possible for her. Westfield and public higher education, I would say in general, is a point of access. It is the place that people can afford to go. It keeps people close to the communities that they want to be close to. And for many students, it is the best place to plan the next stage in their lives. And the liberal arts I have seen help students forge paths that have become hugely meaningful for them, creating careers that they didn't know existed before they came to college. Before I hand this panel over to our three panelists, I want to take a moment, if I may, to name my father, who was the class of 1962 at Amherst and who died just over a month ago. He knew that I was putting together this panel, and he was happy that I was doing so, and he would have been in the audience today. I don't think we had this term back in 1958, but he was a first-generation college student at Amherst. His parents hadn't gone to college, and he was an English major here who wrote about Emily Dickinson. And I really think about how his education here, his study of English, the work he did here, changed his life, pointed him in a direction that he didn't know he could go in. And now in my new role as the dean at Westfield, the dean of the very subjects that are under threat, all of those departments that were threatened at Stevens Point, they're in my college. I'm the dean of arts, humanities, and social science. In my new role, I'm guided by that sense of the value of a really full liberal arts education and the many ways that we as a nation can make sure that education is broadly accessible and what we would lose if it is threatened in our public colleges and universities. So with those introductory remarks, I'm going to hand it over to our first panelist, Jonathan Flatley, who's from Maine State. Thank you.
So, as Emily noted, thanks Emily for putting this together. I'm an English professor at Wayne State University in Detroit. I've been there since 2003. It's like a large public research university. We got about 17,000 undergraduates and about 10,000 graduate and professional students, which is down about 3,000 from 10 years ago. It's like, you know, whatever. It's a good academic job. I'm a full professor with tenure. My teaching load is two classes a semester, and I more or less get to choose what I teach. I have smart PhD students. I get a semester off after every six semesters teaching. There's like nice research support. The university seems to recognize, like, you know, whatever, when I like publish a book or something, they're like, great job. Most of the time, I'm engaged and excited by my work. Yet, among faculty and graduate students, it is hard to escape the sense that our profession is being abolished. The hit seems to have come especially hard at public universities, where it is increasingly clear that the relentless attack on any value not immediately serving the accumulation and circulation of capital is aggressively at work. A new academic administrative class, which has displaced all but the semblance of faculty self-governance, appears mainly to value the data of assessment and the empty discourse of excellence. The only defense of the humanities, itself very weak, that universities can seem to muster is that, like, studying literature or history or French or creative writing or whatever might help to create entrepreneurial individuals or other innovators will create something valued by the local business community. The idea of training people to be thoughtful and educated citizens, for instance, or people interested in, like, trying to figure out how to save the planet from burning, and the possibility that this may even require a certain hostility, or at least indifference to business, that idea doesn't seem to have very much currency these days. To be sure, the ideas that do come to have some kind of administrative force, depend on the makeup of the relevant funding authority, i.e. the state government, or more nearly the lobbyists who fund their campaigns and write the legislation that they pass. And, you know, in Michigan, we recently had a governor who, along with the state legislature, poisoned the water in Flint, Michigan, as, like, a money-saving, like, move. Not that the Democrats are much better. Everyone, it seems, wants to increase productivity and to cut costs, which requires a robust and innovative administrative class. So, like, my own department, like my university, has been damaged by the shrinkage and the budget cuts. Basically, after the financial crisis, we had 9 straight years of budget cuts, and the university just made budget every year by not replacing people who left, through retirement or because they were, fleeing a sinking ship. And this, unsurprisingly, has left huge gaps. Just in my department, we used to have, like, a film major and department that we kept together with 6 faculty. That's now down to 2. We've lost 6 faculty. We've gone down from 33 to 27 tenure track faculty just in the last 4 years. We don't have anyone in an English department. There's a PhD granting department, incidentally, that that works on British literature after, like, 1830. The administration, on the other hand, which has grown, 106 new administrators since 2015, adding $16 million to the administrative budget. The administration has been clear with us that the ideas of replacing people who leave is over. Indeed, this past year, the provost took new hiring out of the sphere of individual departments and instead initiated a interdisciplinary hire in big data. So the English department, we did manage to, like, get 2 new hires from this initiative, but, like, if faculty in the department were asked, like, who, like, what are the areas you need to hire in, big data would not have been, like, in the top 10. It's like, it's not even, nobody was like, well, we really needed someone who's, building models to analyze how many allegorical, so the administrative takeover has, it must be said, made the university, has succeeded in making the university more productive. If we think that the commodity that we're producing is like graduates, that we're like a factory that's like producing graduates, and the graduation rate has increased from 26 to 47% over a 6-year period. And this task was undertaken because state funding was pegged directly to this criteria, which, incidentally, was very poorly suited to Wayne State. So it's like there's 3 research universities in Michigan. There's University of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne. Wayne is like the 3rd. And it serves like a working class, often working population in Detroit. It's people who often take like 8 or 10 years to finish their degrees. So basically the way that Wayne responded to this is it just sort of stopped letting all those people sort of cut those people out. But also, like, the, Detroit is a majority black city. It's like 85% black. The black student population went from around 35% to around 16 or 17% during this time because, unsurprisingly, black school districts around Michigan have also been especially hardly hit. They've just been decimated. And the best way to improve graduation rates, it turns out, is to admit people who are coming from better prepared high schools. So the pressure to cut costs and increase efficiency led the administration to also try to eliminate the protections of tenure so that they could, what they wanted to be able to do is they wanted to be able to fire professors, but even more, they wanted to be able to shut down departments, as Emily was talking about, for their phrase, financial flexibility. But without the union, and our willingness to strike, we had to authorize a strike, we just would have lost the protections of tenure at that moment. We have our contract is up and we're coming up again next year. So the collapse of the job market for PhDs, which nobody's really figured out how to address or absorb, makes the already grim situation of graduate students and adjunct teachers even more punishing than it already was. A recent piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education that has been much cited details the statistics. The number of jobs in English advertised on the annual MLA job list has declined by 55% since 2008, adjuncts now account for all but a quarter of college instructors generally. Colleges from 2013 to 2016 cut 651 foreign language programs nationally. Although I'm buoyed by recent efforts to organize, I must admit that I am not at all optimistic. I mean, those of us who work in universities, about our collective resistance to these attacks on our working conditions and indeed our livelihood as such, which would require much broader solidarity than has so far been felt or made. I've got about 2 minutes. These changes have transformed the job quite significantly. It should be said, the mood, both collectively and individually, is not so good. Because the whole enterprise of higher education and the intellectual life it has made possible seems increasingly precarious, I feel vulnerable and anxious, even with tenure. While I know that this anxiety is not just personal, that its origin is systemic, and that the mood of anxiety is shared, I feel the absence of a collectivity to oppose these developments and the vulnerability that is their product. Without such a collectivity, the feeling of vulnerability is left to reverberate in my own personal situation, shaping the quality and rhythm of my daily concerns, amplifying, for instance, my self-critical worries about the always already late book manuscripts, essay, tenure report, book review, papers to grade, and sharpening my resentment and deepening my despondence about the latest disregard for my working conditions coming from the university or departmental administration. What's to be done? I actually don't think that more energetic or eloquent or persuasive or rational defenses of the humanities matter at all. This is about power. And there's a lot more to say here, but for somebody like me, who believes that power comes from below, the key question is how to assemble a collective, a group, capable of shifting the balance of power, of dislinking the public from private profits. To save the humanities, and indeed public higher education more generally, we would need, at the very least, I think, the solidarity of all college teachers. But it couldn't stop there, and it would have to be oriented not towards increasing productivity, but given the urgencies of this moment, towards something like the survival of the planet and how the university is necessary for that project, which is to say the project of restructuring the global economy, on a fundamental level. That's it. Thanks.
My name is Mimi Long. I teach Japanese literature at UC Irvine, and I'm talking more about the backlines. UC system is still intact to some degree, and I'm just going to tell some stories. So I did a PhD in Japanese literature at Princeton, and I started teaching in 1997 in the comparative literature department at SUNY Buffalo. Then in 2003, I moved to Comp Lit at UC Riverside. In 2015, 4 years ago, I moved to East Asian Studies at UC Irvine. So I've been teaching liberal arts in the public university for 21 years. Although I was aware during the first 15 years of my career that both the State University of New York and the University of California were sliding away from academic self-governance and toward rule from above by larger and larger numbers of administrators with bloated salaries and mandates to run the university like a corporation, I spent my spare brainwaves learning how to teach. This took a long time. To help you imagine my students, I want to offer some numbers. At UC Riverside, where I taught for 13 years, we have 20,000 undergraduates, of whom 57% are first-generation college students, 52% get Pell Grants, and an estimated 60% are food insecure. Both Riverside and Irvine now operate basic needs pantries for emergency food and toiletries. Demographically, Riverside's undergraduates are 30% Asian, 40% Hispanic, 4% Black, 14% White, and 7% International. And then, comparatively, at UC Irvine, where I teach now, we have 30,000 undergraduates, of whom 50% are first generation, 46% receive Pell Grants, 45% are food insecure, and 32% are transfer students from community colleges who come after 2 years and finish at Irvine. At Irvine, the students are 35% Asian, 24% Hispanic, 2% Black, 14% White, and 18% International. Now, at both schools, annual tuition in 2018 and 2019, the year just passed, was $15,400 for California residents and $44,500 for non-residents. These figures represent precipitous increases gradually after 2008, when resident tuition was $5,800 and non-resident tuition was $6,400. Room, board, and expenses add about $20,000 to the 2019 figure. Riverside has a graduation rate of 75%. Irvine's rate is 83%. At both schools, the average student graduates with $22,000 in debt. Although the undergrads at Irvine, which ranks fourth or fifth academically among the 10 UC campuses, are better prepared than the undergraduates at Riverside, which ranks eighth or ninth, partially because California itself ranks 45th of 50 states in per capita K-12 education, at neither campus have I generally had more than one student in a class who can write well. Assigned more than 50 pages of weekly reading reliably prompts a quarter of the students to drop the class after they see the syllabus. Assume no background and no interest. This is the motto of my friends amongst the faculty who are realistic. Despite the challenges of the state's ever-shrinking support and amidst the incredible richness of socioeconomic and racial diversity, what my students taught me about teaching were four main points. One, they want to be held to higher intellectual standards, not lower. To get them to take my class seriously, to take humanities education seriously, I have to take them seriously and frame big questions, mostly about power. They want to hear on a regular basis that I know they can meet these standards, and that I care whether they do. They want to hear that writing is hard for me, that it's hard for everyone who writes well, but it's also crucial and empowering and coachable. In every class, I use a 12-point memo called Common Writing Mistakes and How to Fix Them. Finally, fourth, they want to hear about the importance of the reading experience, that they need to find big blocks of time for novels and short stories, that they need to immerse themselves for real, with their brains and their hearts away from screens. So when I applied to Irvine from Riverside in 2014, I remember realizing for the first time that I had confidence in my teaching. I had learned how to teach at Riverside. I wrote that although I'd been in the classroom for 17 years, I only figured out what I was doing in the past two or three. No sooner did I arrive at Irvine with this set of skills than the folks from Humanities Commons, which is the research and fundraising arm of the School of Humanities, got in touch. Mimi, they said, you are new and energetic and have a great book project on literature and activism after Fukushima. Why don't you apply to the Japanese government for a $450,000 Japan Foundation grant to fund two new faculty positions? Thanks, I said. But it's precisely because I want to write my book on literature and activism after Fukushima and teach my classes that I don't want to be the principal investigator on the big grant. Also, shouldn't the dean just give us the faculty position? In the end, I wrote the grant. It took and continues to take an enormous amount of time. I have not yet finished my book. We didn't get $450,000 from the Japan Foundation, but we did get $322,000, and this made me very popular with the dean. Meanwhile, the grant made me very unpopular with the majority of the humanities faculty. They had long been resisting the new normal, in which departments get faculty lines not with retirements or increased enrollments, but only by wooing outside money. Recently at Irvine, three $1.5 million endowed chairs in Hindu studies, Jain studies, and Zoroastrian studies had been gratefully accepted from rich private donors, despite the fact that the School of Humanities has no department of religion, and crucial faculty positions in established fields were going unfilled. I have one final anecdote about my efforts to redeem myself with the faculty resistors, to move at least incrementally towards what Jonathan referred to, although not in the same context, as a need for national solidarity amongst college teachers. It's an anecdote about my campus's writing requirements and how it's being dismantled by the School of Humanities itself in an effort to please the campus-wide administration. So I said earlier that after the crash of 2008, when the state withdrew funding from public education and from the UC system, tuition went from $5,800 in-state and $6,400 out-of-state to $15,400 in-state and $44,500 out-of-state. The reason Irvine's undergraduate population is now 18% international, and the reason out-of-state tuition is now $44,000 before room and board, is that the upper administration made good entrepreneurial decisions and capitalized on California's popularity with students from mainland China, who make up 14% of that 18% international figure. To accommodate these students, an entire new department of academic English has been created, and ESL students are required to pass a certain number of courses there before advancing to the campus-wide required composition series, English 39A, B, and C. A few weeks ago, having found myself on an elected body called the Humanities Executive Council, I listened to the chair of English as he asked us to approve a plan to allow California students to test out of these two of the three required courses. Because the School of Humanities is one of 15 schools in which students major, including biological sciences, business, education, engineering, computer science, nursing, health, pharmacy, social sciences, and physical sciences, the campus-wide writing program is one of the few ways we reliably draw non-humanities students into our classes. In addition, the English 39 series is extremely well-designed, a true source of rigorous thinking, and a bulwark against fake news. But the chair of English told us that the 39 ABC series is increasingly disliked by California students because the influx of international students has oriented the tenor of instruction towards English as a second language. The idea that academic English alone could address this population's needs was overly optimistic, he said. And meanwhile, the English department, like every other in the humanities, had had its budget cut. It did not have enough lecturers to meet the demand of the required courses. There was a long backlog of students who couldn't get in. To graduate them on time, the school needed to allow more of them to test out of the course using AP credits. At a subsequent humanities town hall run by the Executive Council, of which I'm a member, I asked the dean and the various assembled associate deans, if it's true that UCI chose to admit large numbers of international students to fill its empty coffers, shouldn't some guaranteed portion of those tuition dollars go toward ensuring that departments tasked with teaching the new student population have enough money to hire lecturers and teach their core courses? Where can we get a clear budget summary of how much money UCI generates each year with international tuition and how much stays in the School of Humanities? This question was met with embarrassed silence. Eventually, the dean said, somewhat sheepishly, well, if we had admitted all the international students, we would have needed to raise tuition for the California students. The idea that the state of California would resume paying to educate its own citizens was not mentioned. Then the conversation turned back to grants and donors.
There's time, I want to talk about a website I'll show in a second. I also have some anecdotes to share if there are also time. So my talk is really very brief. I tried to imagine what my very distinguished co-panelists would have said, and it turns out when they gave me a preview just before this panel, I'm largely right. So I have some summarizing remarks about the crisis of higher education, which I think is precisely the words for it today. And then some comparative remarks about the differences I encountered after 30 years of teaching English at Amherst to the 7 years now of teaching French and comparative literature at Rutgers. Since the Obama administration, there's been a change in public perception of what college is for. Parents today are apt to remind their college-bound children that the choice of a major has financial consequences. You may be having these conversations with your own children, or at least know people who are having those conversations with their children. that the consequences, the financial consequences, are amongst other things, how much money a family is expected to contribute to a child's education. The always murky historical distinction that goes back at least to Plato between applied and pure research has been reborn in the past decade or so as an opposition between vocational training and the liberal arts, but with the liberal arts now the devalued term. You may remember Obama, it's a throw-off line about art history. Why would you major in art history? Useless major. Uselessness was one of the definitions, traditional definitions of what you studied, that it had no practical use, and that was prized for that. The exception to this trend of devaluing the liberal arts is the elite private institution, whose continuing commitment to the liberal arts is a good thing, although it carries with it a class-based presumption that vocational education is for others, which is not such a good thing. The neoliberal disinvestment in public education began earlier than the Obama administration, but has accelerated from then to now. And since 2007, state funding of public universities has declined nationally by 20%. So it's different at different institutions. Interesting to hear, more or less the only thing that we can be sure of having in common are committees. Vanessa and your institutions are also different that, in the way that public monies peter down or not, and to whom. With this disinvestment is the, Jonathan referred to, the collapse of a market for academic labor, the rise of part-time instructors. This is not at all independent of the disinvestment in public education. At Rutgers, I'm sorry to say, part-time faculty now teach 70% of all undergraduate courses. Part-time faculty are faculty who not only have no benefits, but there's no continuity in what they teach from one semester to another. So, coming to Rutgers after 30 years at Amherst was a shock. An example, I remember vividly the Amherst faculty in this very room sometime in the late 1980s rejecting forcefully a proposal from General Electric to fund a course of its own design that the college was going to offer. And the faculty wouldn't have any of that. At Rutgers, if this happened, we would call this an innovative public-private partnership. Things have changed. Rutgers has an undergraduate school of business in which students can major in supply chain management. I teach many of these students who find their way into humanities classrooms only because of the core requirements that they must fulfill to graduate. It is not a chore to teach these students. That many of them actually get excited about what they didn't know that they didn't know, and that's always a pleasure. Rutgers undergraduates turn out to be a lot like Amherst undergraduates, except that there are a lot more of them. 36,000 on the New Brunswick flagship campus alone. There are two other campuses, one in Newark and one in Camden. So it's 36,000 versus the 1,700 or so at Amherst. What they have in common, Rutgers and Amherst, is that 22% of the students are on Pell Grants. But 22% of 36,000 is a lot more than 22% of 1,700. But this, on the other hand, and this is where the inequality lies, Rutgers' endowment is $15,000 per student, rounded up, versus Amherst's $1.141 million per student. This disparity in institutional wealth is evident in just about every aspect of college life. when I had decided to leave Amherst, the then president, Tony Marks, said, "But Andy, you'll have plastic chairs you'll be sitting in." This disparity affects just about every aspect of college life, I said, starting with the fact that only first-year students live on campus at Rutgers, and that afterwards, most students commute from home. Many of our students take their first 2 years at a local community college before transferring to Rutgers in their third and fourth year. It's because the tuition is so much cheaper at a community college. Rutgers undergraduates don't run into each other outside of class, and almost never drop in on faculty office hours. That's my anecdote. I'll tell you about the one who ended up doing it. But that the fact that Amherst is a residential community, and it would be very misleading to describe a large public university like urban public university like Rutgers in those terms. I'll close these comments with yet another statistic. Nearly 60% of Rutgers undergraduates speak a language other than English at home with their parents and or grandparents. It's a form of diversity that until recently Rutgers never measured or even acknowledged as a value, whether for the institution itself or for this mass of multilingual students. To serve these students, as I hope we will require more than only an increase in public funding, but also a rediscovery of the liberal arts. And I do hope that that's still possible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Does this work? Okay, fabulous. Thank you. We're beautiful, fabulous papers. And we have 20 minutes to hear your questions for our panel. Debbie.
I thought that was a terrific panel. I'm so glad I came, even if I came late. And I'm glad I stayed awake. I'm curious, thinking about starting with Jonathan's thing, is there something about late-stage 21st century capitalism inherently, logically, that demands disinvestment in the education that you would think they would be? You would think that like this stage of capitalism wants more education, at least for some class. Is there something about it, or is that a cultural thing that we could change incrementally? Do we have to change the whole system to change that, or are there cultural changes or other kinds of changes, power changes that are smaller?
I mean, you know, if you have a good theory of how capital works these days, you win like a Nobel Prize or whatever. So I'm not confident in describing accurately the state of capital that we're in. But I think it's pretty clear that since the 70s, the disinvestment from public education has been constant and ongoing. That happens to correspond with the declining rate of profit. So there's a pretty strong correspondence between those economic indicators and the disinvestment in public education. What the exact mechanism of the cause is may not be particularly clear, and I suspect that it's overdetermined. I think at the very least, though, it's possible to slow down those changes if you organize the workforce. University can't operate at all without teachers and students. So, although administrators don't seem to, you know, whatever, we're just employees, right? We're just like, you know. So I think that transformation would be possible, you know. But in all honesty, I think a more full-fledged, opposition to capitalism as it's now operating would actually be required in order to reverse the current trends.
It couldn't hurt.
I mean, whatever. But things on the table. Things on the table right now, like free public college, or forgiving the massive amounts of student debt. That would surely make sort of
key changes in the way that students experience their education. And the thing about that I think everybody noted is the way that students coming into college have a completely instrumental relationship mm-hmm. to their education. And I think as long as that's the case, the humanities are done, right? There's no the instrumental defenses of the humanities, I think, are very weak, as Andy noted. So as long as, so if college is all of a sudden free, that I think changes that equation.
Let me continue this this discussion a little bit, if I could. It seems to me that a good starting point is to locate the crisis of higher education in the state system in the wider flow of capital, and that means not just the private sector. I want to argue that even the Amherst's and the privates are feeling some of the effects of yes. what you were just calling neoliberalism. I would use the same term, but we could have various choices. So we're talking about the health system, we're talking about government generally, we're talking about the education system, and we're talking about the shift from regular faculty to part-time faculty is the way you run things everywhere, including Harvard. I don't know what the figures are for Amherst. It's certainly much lower than at Rutgers. Much lower than at Binghamton, where I taught, but this is the larger structure. So I think we have to locate it in this set of terms. I wanna wonder whether Amherst doesn't share more of this dialogue than what I'm hearing mm-hmm. so far, and in particular the sense that young people. I don't know if there are a lot of students here. Probably not. That students feel the instrumentality, which is what is at the heart of what you're describing as the decline of the humanities. It's much slower at Amherst than elsewhere. They have less to worry. They could stay home for a couple of years and Papa would pick up the charge. But nevertheless, in our generation, we didn't give very much thought to how we're going to make a living later. We chose, you know, maybe we were interested in English or art or whatever. And I think this is across the board. In the states and in the privates as well, and I think we see it in the kinds of majors that are being chosen. At Amherst, for example, math and computer sciences are very big. Lots of good reasons for that, even intellectual reasons. But I think this is the part of the wider structure of what we're seeing.
I completely agree.
And also that Amherst is not immune from these trends at all.
I mean, the thing that I teach at Wayne, but I was visiting recently at NYU for 2 years, which is a different kind of neoliberal institution. But there, it's a different set of preoccupations, because at NYU, instead of worrying about the state legislature, they're worried about the like 10 billionaires that they depend on for their funding. So there's a great deal of anxiety about the local billionaires at places like this. Or like, you know, they're getting a ton of money from Abu Dhabi, right? It's, oil money is like really important as well. So even though I think there's the overall structure is shared, how it plays out at the individual places is importantly distinct.
Yeah. I wonder if you are all aware that while you have been talking, on the screen is a New York Times page that right now has a set ad for cybersecurity from Starbucks, but for a while was flashing
Christine.
Yeah. So I thought that perhaps you could turn it off since it doesn't seem to be relevant. But also,
I did.
That you have also been running advertising during the
time. Yeah.
It's good that this didn't just register subliminally.
Yes.
I wonder if it's too patient to argue, well, it's really hard to defend humanities instrumentally, therefore we go to a worldwide revolution. You know, that's a pretty big difference to make, and it's no easy matter to change capitalism. Right? So, I mean, all of those graduates of Amherst who were the ones presumably have a very vivid understanding of the value of what they study. And, you know, you can think of it in terms of skills and insight, ability to communicate from living, to survive sort of in as leaders of communities. And obviously there are instrumentally valuable outcomes that those of us in the liberal arts can and do talk about. And I think it may be distasteful to talk to the business press using their language. But as you said, if the families are teaching their kids, damn it, choose a major that makes money or I won't pay you, we can address that real easily. Because by God, the skills and the insights that we benefited from through the arts are valuable in the marketplace. So it strikes me there is a very plausible instrumental case you could make, which is much more plausible than hoping for a revolution.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I make that case like all the time.
Just turn it off.
It hasn't.
Why?
Well, I make it to my students. I mean, I also believe it. I mean, it's like whatever. I have working class students, and I sort of tell them like, look, you know, it's an introductory writing class. Reading like history of African American literature, I'm telling them like, look, if you can write clearly, that's going to set you apart from like 90% of the other people applying for whatever job that you're applying for. I mean, I think they believe that, and that's sort of, you know, I mean, it's and I think that that's true, and I mean, my relation to my students is I'm just trying to help them with like class mobility. They're just worried about like being poor or whatever. So, you know, I'm trying to give them real advice about like what things will actually help them.
And that's powerful. That responds to the executive that we see, right?
But we've all been doing that for the last 10 years, and it no effect. Things keep getting worse. So, you know, I'm pessimistic about the future of the humanities for that very reason.
We have a question.
I would love to follow up on that directly because I work for the UW system and they recently paid a lot of money to a consulting company called Burning Glass. And Burning Glass came in and they did this, you know, extensive study where they went out into the community, they talked to employers, and, you know, found out like where our graduates from our different majors were going and what those employers said were the most valuable skills that the people coming from those majors could possibly have for that job. And we had to sit through an 8-hour workshop that was supposedly tailored to every single major, and it was all the same. Employers want you to be able to communicate clearly and write well. So even when they pay an insane amount of money to get data, they claim they want to be responsive to data, and they get that information, it still doesn't sink in. It doesn't sink in that this is what we're giving them, and you can't...
I saw a hand there, sure. And then there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a implicit rejection of sort of a nostalgia for a baseline period where, like, higher education was whiter and more upper class. I mean, there is a reality, despite the crisis, talking about more...
You have nostalgia about that?
Well, then we're talking about a period when the humanities was more respect. And I'm saying, it was a period also when less people got to get access to it. So the crisis is happening at the same time that there have been achievements in more people going to college, more, a higher percentage of both by race, by income. But at the same time, to deal with that, the system is putting all these pressures on the system. So, but I think you have to deal with both why some of the pressures have existed, what some of the changes are. I mean, I'm an adjunct teaching at both a public college and online, so I'm at the right front line of even the back end of the back end. So I recognize this is happening. But I also teach kids who would never have been in school 30, 40 years ago. So they're there, and that's an achievement. And so trying to figure out that, yes, public, you know, local governments are dealing with budget crises that are all hard. And yes, they're taking it out of higher ed because, frankly, if you go down the list, higher ed is surviving better. K-12 is in desperate state in most areas. Relatively, higher ed is looking better. If I'm a budget person, I understand why it's not good, but you understand why everybody here, because there is money you can pull into higher ed. Nobody from Dubai is sending money to our K-12 anyway. So I'm just saying there's a broader crisis that this is embedded in, and even talking about instrumentality and selling it is only part of a broader set of budget crises amidst some successes. So I'm just saying, I think to talk about the success has to be, I think, even broader than within the university system. And so there's a lot happening, but I think it's harder to work through.
I mean, I think that's true and right, except it's not locally true at where I teach at Wayne State, where enrollment has gone. I mean, you know, so in the 1990s it was like $500 a year to go to Wayne State, and it's now 13,000. So for working class kids, that's a pretty significant difference, and enrollment has dropped correspondingly.